Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Virginia Mason Clinic Didactic Podcast, written for our Virginia Mason internal medicine residents. Today, we are going to be covering a very important topic, osteoporosis, and joining me today as the expert on the topic is Dr. Anant Shenoy, one of my colleagues.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on.
And we do want to give credit to Dr. Chris Yee from King County Public Health, who is our core faculty, who had been working and put together this didactic and had updated it from the Yale Medicine didactic that was put together by Dr. Janet Henrich and Dr. Laura Whitman. So, Dr. Shenoy, shall we get a little bit of background and some learning goals?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Mohan. So we're going to cover a couple of different aspects today, assuming you're going to give me some cases and you'll let me talk. So we're going to talk about who should be screened for osteoporosis. In addition to hopefully what we all know is women of average risk at 65 years and older. We're also going to talk about the different criteria to treat osteoporosis and review interventions to treat osteoporosis and when to consider when we need to get a second opinion or rather get an expert involved with endocrinology. As a little bit of a reminder for background, osteoporosis is a silent disease, although I'm sure we've all had patients who've said they hurt because of osteoporosis. But it's a silent disease and can, of course, cause pretty severe outcomes from fractures and the morbidity and mortality associated with those fractures. It turns out about 50% of women and 30% of men will experience an osteoporotic fracture in their lifetime. So it is one of the highest incidences of something that will occur out of all the conditions that we treat. The one-year mortality after a hip fracture is about 38% in men and 28% in women, which is just staggeringly high. Like, that's comparable to, like, cancers. And in regards to morbidity, approximately 20% of hip fracture patients require long-term nursing home care, and 60% do not fully regain their pre-fracture independence. So just from a health systems and a country standpoint, it's a tremendous burden. Now, treatment helps prevent initial and recurrent fractures, and the relative risk reduction of hip fractures with bisphosphonate treatment for at least 3 years is 36%, which from a standpoint of relative risk is a pretty good reduction, and given the lifetime incidence of fractures, the absolute risk reduction isn't bad either. At-risk patients are often not screened to establish fracture probability and are usually not educated about fracture prevention, and that falls on all of us to do better. And the majority of highest risk women and men who have fractures are not diagnosed and do not receive effective therapies, which is very sad. And 80 to 95% of patients in some practice settings are discharged following a hip fracture repair without anti-fracture treatment or management plan for their osteoporosis, which is just kind of staggering. Like, would we discharge someone with coronary artery disease without putting them on a statin and an aspirin? Hopefully not 80 to 95% of people. So with that, Dr. Mohan, if it's okay, I just want to also review our health inequity spotlight. So as a reminder, we try to cover this as much as we can in our weekly series, just as a reminder of the disparities in healthcare that we are all responsible for addressing. So Black women are less likely to be screened than other racial groups, and Black women are 10% less likely to be treated than white women for osteoporosis. Hispanic and Black women are 60% less likely to receive bone density testing after hip fracture, and right, as we already reviewed, just in general, screening isn't great. Now, concerns also exist regarding the validity of race-specific FRAX calculators, which, of course, this is the tool that we'll discuss later today and is the main tool we use to estimate risk. Because hip fracture incidence in the U.S. is lower in most non-white racial and ethnic groups, interestingly, and predicted fracture risk estimates for Asian, Black, and Hispanic patients will always be lower than for white persons of the same age, sex, weight, bone mineral density, and clinical risk factors in the FRAX model, which could lead to racial and ethnic differences in who is offered treatment among persons of otherwise identical age, bone mineral density, and clinical risk profile. So just a really helpful reminder, like, risk calculators can have the same racial biases that we all can have. And Native Americans have bone mineral density similar to non-Hispanic whites, but higher rates of hip fracture, which could reflect the challenges and limitations of our health systems in terms of screening, could reflect their access to nutrition and lifestyle and follow-up, and likely other just systemic racism. So hopefully that is a helpful just review of things that all of us have an obligation to be aware of and to address.
Yes, and I think it is going to be very helpful that one of the things we're going to be talking about first up is actually screening about osteoporosis, because it sounds like this is probably an area where we can really make the most benefit in addressing these healthcare inequities. All right, so we're going to jump into cases. And as always, these cases are theoretical. There is no protected health information being shared of any patients because none of these patients actually exist in real life. So case one, a 62-year-old Caucasian woman with no significant past medical history or active medical problems presents for a routine health maintenance visit. Since her last visit with you, she reports that her elderly mother has become increasingly hunched over and shorter in height and has started recently on treatment for osteoporosis. She is concerned that she also may have thin bones. Your patient smokes half a pack of cigarettes per day but is trying to cut down and has a few drinks each night to unwind. Her vitals include a height of 5'8", weight 125 pounds, pro BMI of 19, blood pressure of 130 over 80, and pulse of 80. So, as promised, my first question to you is who should be screened for osteoporosis and how?
Thank you, Dr. Mohan. And I will just say, for that case, there are a couple of points we probably need to address just for their overall health, not only their bone mineral density. But back to your question. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is kind of the authority that most of us really rely on in primary care, they recommend that all women who are 65 years and older, as well as postmenopausal women less than 65 who are at increased risk for osteoporosis, should be screened. So that's key. So it's not just women who are 65 years and older, it's those who are at increased risk that we might screen at a younger age. Now, other professional organizations agree with these recommendations. And when we think about risk factors that might modify when we screen, i.e. screen earlier, so someone who's a history of fracture or history of falls within the last year, a history of premature ovarian insufficiency, hypogonadism, so again, this would be thinking about female body and male body, COPD, hyperparathyroidism, rheumatoid arthritis, and in fact, a number of other autoimmune diseases. So those things in their past medical history should get you thinking they're at increased risk. Now, from family history, if they have parents with a history of fractures or osteoporosis, that might suggest increased risk. In terms of lifestyle, if they are currently a smoker and having excess alcohol consumption, which we'll come back to that patient, I'm sure, in a moment. Then with medications, the big one is chronic corticosteroid use, which hopefully does not need to be said, although there are other medications that can also weaken bone mineral strength or bone strength. Then with imaging, if you literally see osteopenia on x-ray, and I will say I'm not the best one at reading x-ray, but when our radiologists call it out, that is a good red flag. And then when we think about just our exam, if they're at a low body weight, really a BMI less than 21, or just a body weight less than 127 pounds, or if they've been losing height, and I work primarily with the geriatric population, and it's a really nice bonding point when I can ask them, so do you think you've been getting shorter? And they all say yes, and that is a wonderful segue into osteoporosis. Now, for women at increased risk, the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends not getting a DEXA scan immediately. They recommend doing a clinical risk assessment first, and then a DEXA if sufficiently high enough for risk. So
I'm going to lead into that a little bit more. So we talked quite a bit about women. So of course, there's the question of, well, what are the recommendations for men for osteoporosis screening?
Yeah, and this comes up probably less often than it should, because again, we, as covered in our background, that indeed, we don't screen as much as we should. So I really look at this as an opportunity to be thinking about, again, this is a risk-based assessment. And when are our male patients going to be at risk? Because again, under-recognized, under-diagnosed, and we just don't do as good a job with men. And as we already talked about, we don't even do a good enough job with women. So the men or male body patients who should undergo screening are those over the ages of 50 and older who have a risk factors for osteoporosis, which hopefully makes sense to our listeners, Dr. Mohan. Like if you're at greater risk, that's when you should be screened. As far as in general screening, rather than like as we know with women at 65, again thinking menopause and loss of estrogen, for men the age threshold for average risk is 70 and above. So generally men age 70 and above should be screened, and those with higher risk should be screened at an earlier age. And we do have data that supports this. I won't dive into it. However, I will note that the United States Preventive Services Task Force does not have a recommendation, which is not the same as them recommending not to do something. So I think that's a key difference.
I think that's a really good point. The unfortunate thing is that when they do not recommend something, it is much harder for us to get Medicare coverage. So that is probably our limiting factor right there, is being able to get somebody a screening study that is actually covered as a preventative study. All right, so we are going to now talk about assessing your patient's risk of osteoporosis, and tell me a little bit about what clinical risk assessment tool you would use.
Yeah, so this is really, I think, the heart of the topic. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force endorses several equally performing risk assessment tools. However, like the Fracture Risk Assessment Tool, which you probably heard of as FRAX, which is kind of developed and supported by the World Health Organization, is probably the most commonly used one, or at least one of the most commonly used risk assessment tools. Now, its primary advantage is that it calculates an abstract risk score using the clinical information that you provide it to estimate a 10-year probability of both a hip fracture or of any major osteoporotic fracture, which includes like hip, spine, proximal humerus, or wrist. And FRAX is a web-based algorithm. It was developed using population data from countries across 5 continents and has been pretty extensively validated. So that's probably the reason why it is the most commonly used one. This is also another website I literally have bookmarked on my browser, and I see Dr. Mohan nodding. For those who are listening, they can't see it. I'm guessing she also has it bookmarked. So basically, my answer to this question, we generally use FRAX.
Yes, and I would definitely recommend using the Mayo Decision Aid for osteoporosis, which has a lovely visual calculator for demonstrating the FRAX to your patients, and also helpful for some of the other things we're going to talk about in regards to treatment and risk factors and side effects from treatment. So let's start calculating out a FRAX. So what would be her FRAX score if she is drinking 3 drinks a night based on the other information already given, and how is that going to differ based on race or ethnicity?
Really good question. And I'm not actually going to walk you through entering the numbers into the FRAX calculator. I trust everybody can pull it up and go through, but you gave us the important information in the question stem. So when we put that in, her 10-year probability of a major osteoporotic fracture is 12%, and of a hip fracture, it is 3.9%. This is assuming that she is white or Caucasian. If she were Black, the numbers are different. And again, remember that we called out in the Health Equity Spotlight, this may be underestimating that. But her 10-year risk of major fracture is 5.5% and of hip 1.7%. If she were Hispanic, it would be 6.9% and then a 2.2% hip. And for Asian, 6.9% for any major osteoporotic fracture and 2.2% for hip. And the reason why the calculators give a lower number is that the fracture risks in general are lower in these populations. So, but again, I'm not going to belabor it by going through the calculator with everyone.
All right. So given these results, would you measure her bone density and explain your reasoning?
Yeah, so again, we're thinking about this in terms of risk. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends measuring the bone mineral density using a DEXA in women aged 65 years and older and in younger women whose 10-year risk of fracture is equal to or greater than that of a 65-year-old white woman of mean height and weight without any other risk factors. And so what that means basically is if their 10-year risk is greater than 8.4% by your risk assessment tool, it is suggested to proceed with a DEXA scan, that is to do the testing. Now, in her case, she is less than 65 years of age, which is why it makes sense to do a risk assessment. And of course, the fact that she's worried, it can be helpful to literally show her the numbers and explain your reasoning. I will just say as a brief aside, I found this is one of the more emotive issues. Like patients who come in asking and concerned about their bone density generally really like to get their DEXAs. That is what I personally found in my practice. And so being able to review your reasoning can be very helpful, particularly if you don't think a DEXA is necessary. Now, her 10-year risk of major osteoporotic fracture 12% exceeds that threshold that I mentioned, so of average risk of a 65-year-old. So therefore, she should have her bone mineral density tested. And if she was of a different race or ethnicity, again, as I reviewed those numbers before, she wouldn't meet that threshold for a DEXA.
All right, so you order a DEXA, it comes back. For the hip, the femoral neck T-score is -1. The total hip T-score is -0.6, and the Z-score is 0.1. For the spine, L1 is -1.9, L2 is -1.7, L3 is -1.9, L4 is -2.4, and the mean lumbar spine score of 1 to 4 is a T-score of -2 and a Z-score of -1.2. So now that I've thrown all these numbers at you, what is the difference between a T-score and a Z-score, and how are they interpreted?
Yeah, thank you for going through all those numbers and then asking me about them. Really appreciate that, Dr. Mohan. So, for a reminder for everybody, the T-score is the standard deviation difference between an individual's bone mineral density and that of a normal young adult of the same age, gender, and race. The lower the T-score, the greater the risk of fracture, with a reminder that lower means the more negative that it is. The Z-score is the standard deviation difference between an individual's bone mineral density and that of an age-matched controlled adult of the same age and gender. A Z-score less than -2.0 raises concerns about secondary causes of osteoporosis. The T-score is used to place individuals into diagnostic categories, defined by the World Health Organization as normal, which is when you have a bone mineral density within one standard deviation of a normal young adult. So a T-score basically above -1. So greater than -1, so less -C, less negative. The next category is low bone mass, which is kind of the correct term to replace osteopenia. And this is for T-scores between -1 and -2.5. And then finally, osteoporosis, which is with a bone mineral density of 2.5 standard deviations or more below that of a normal young adult. So this is a t-score less than or more negative than minus 2.5. So I know it's not a complete answer, but that's a starting point.
Yeah, so we have a bone mineral density definition for osteoporosis. So how else can osteoporosis be diagnosed other than a T-score of less than negative 2.5?
I think this is a really important point of emphasis. Ultimately, osteoporosis is a clinical diagnosis, more so than a DEXA diagnosis. So a clinical diagnosis can be made in the presence of a fragility fracture. Remember, the point of all of this is to identify those who are at risk of fragility fractures. That's the whole point. So someone who's already proven to you that they have, like they basically fracture, they've had a fragility fracture, they by definition have osteoporosis. To be blunt, I then don't care what the DEXA says. So just as a reminder, fragility fractures, particularly those are like those at the spine, the hip, the distal radius, the humerus, rib, or pelvis. And again, you don't need a bone mineral density for that. Other good reminders, fragility fractures are those that occur spontaneously or from minor trauma. And this is a question that comes up not infrequently. Like, my patient fell, was this minor enough trauma? And kind of, they fell out of a truck, that could break any of our hips. If the ground level fall at low speed, that would be minor trauma. And if they can't even remember the trauma, that by definition is very minor trauma. Again, thinking about those vertebral compression fractures. Now, recent evidence suggests that all fractures except those of the face, skull, hands, and feet are generally associated with low bone mineral density and future fracture risk, independent or irrespective of the association with trauma. And I'm not saying this to like make you change all of your practices, but just to be aware, people who break bones often, probably something going on. One other key point, a frac score with a hip fracture risk greater than 3% or a total fracture risk of greater than 20% and low bone mass between a T-score of minus 1 and minus 2.5. So again, this is someone with a high fracture risk, but they're not in the osteoporosis by a DEXA scan. They still have osteoporosis. Clinical diagnosis, it's a risk assessment. You can't just rely on the DEXA results. And hopefully I belabored that point enough.
Yes. So now let's look at the scores a little bit more closely. So you have several scores at the hip and the spine. So which do you use to diagnose osteoporosis?
Yeah, and this also comes up pretty frequently. So generally, for most radiology groups, scores are going to be reported from two sites, the lumbar spine and the hip. And again, they can be different. We can have different bone mineral densities between those two sites, and there are other things like arthritis that can change what the measurement comes back as. And for classification purposes, the lowest T-score at the total hip, femoral neck, or spine is used to place patients into diagnostic categories. And hopefully that makes sense. Wherever they're weakest is what we should be making our decision based on because they could get fractures there. Now, the average of all four vertebrae is used unless they're like structural changes seen on an image in the DEXA report, like really bad degenerative joint disease or an artifact, you know, like metal hardware or things like that. And generally, our radiologists are really good and they comment on that in the DEXA report. And generally, then the abnormal vertebrae are excluded from analysis. And just as a reminder, really bad degenerative joint disease can actually raise bone mineral density on the scan. And as we all know, osteoarthritis does not make your bones actually stronger. So now, in this case, based on a spine T-score of minus 2.0, the patient has low bone mass, what we used to call osteopenia.
So given these findings, what do you recommend? And would you recommend pharmacologic treatment?
Yeah, so this is another really helpful reminder that osteoporosis, like many of our conditions, tends to be caused by things. While it's easy to label it as this is just a natural part of life and aging, it's important to recognize there can be other causes that we need to address and treat. So you really want to look for secondary causes, particularly if the Z-score is really low, like less than 2.0, again, the Z-score, because it can be helpful for identifying that. And if someone has osteoporosis, you always should do your due diligence to look for secondary causes. So at the very minimum, everybody in these categories should get a vitamin D level, a basic metabolic panel to look at the calcium, and to look at renal function. And now you potentially want to consider a broader workup in certain categories. So you might want to consider a comprehensive metabolic panel to get those liver tests. Think about a parathyroid hormone level, and then potentially testosterone in men who are in that 50 to 69 age year range. If there are other things that make you think about like hypogonadism or hyperparathyroidism, and if that vitamin D level are less than 20, you definitely want to supplement to treat that insufficiency. And again, there's a lot we could talk about in regards to vitamin D and fall prevention and risk reduction. But if it's less than 20, that's a good threshold to be treating. Now, a couple of other points. We want to start with non-pharmacologic interventions. And on this regard, we want to address modifiable risk factors. So in the patient that you mentioned to us, we want to think about smoking cessation and alcohol reduction. Other things that are really helpful, engaging in muscle strengthening, balance, and endurance exercises. This has the goal of preventing falls and strengthening muscle, And then weight-bearing exercises can actually help build a little bit of bone strength. So exercise is good for so many things. Now, another point that often comes up, because many people would prefer not to take medications, generally the adequate consumption of dietary intake of vitamin D is around 600 to 800 units a day for those over the age of 70, and calcium of 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams a day. It's kind of a component of national nutritional guidelines, and I'll just refer to the Institute of Medicine back in 2010. But the role of calcium and vitamin D supplements to prevent fractures in individuals without osteoporosis or vitamin D deficiency remains uncertain. So those who aren't deficient and don't have osteoporosis, it's unclear what the right thing to do is, because data has been hard to gather here, at least conclusive data. Based on limited data, the United States Preventive Services Task Force found insufficient evidence to assess the benefits of supplementation with vitamin D and calcium daily, alone, or combined to prevent fractures in postmenopausal women. However, they did find adequate evidence that supplementation with these agents increases the risk of kidney stones. Hooray! So, despite insufficient data, though, other organizations do recommend supplements to achieve minimal daily requirements of vitamin D and calcium. And kind of a point from Dr. Yi, he usually tells his patients to make sure that they've been getting vitamin D 800 units, international units a day, and 1,200 units of calcium in their diet, and exercise more caution if they have a history of kidney stones. And I'll also direct Dr. Michael Song has a really wonderful couple of teaching points in regards to the complicated history around vitamin D supplementation and those who have a vested interest in selling vitamin D. Now, I will stop talking in just a moment, Dr. Mohan, but I also want to call out the use of pharmacologic agents to treat low bone density in postmenopausal women without osteoporosis is at times somewhat controversial due to limited data on the effect of treatment in preventing fractures in this specific population. So again, that low bone density, not osteoporosis. Now, the rationale being that fracture risk will usually be lower in their 60s than in your 70s, and given that time limits on the duration of pharmacologic treatment, it may limit the therapeutic options when those patients get older and their bone density does progress to the point of osteoporosis. So you might not want to use your window treatment up when they're just at low bone density. And this, again, is a point I often find that I have to engage in a lot of discussion with certain patients because they are very concerned and they want to do everything they can to prevent fractures, which is wonderful, but sometimes putting people on drugs is not the right answer. Now, the American College of Physicians recommends that treatment decisions in women with low bone mass should be made based on patient preference, fracture risk profile, likelihood of benefits and harms, and cost. But we want to basically consider the pharmacologic treatment for women of any age with low bone mass and no prior fracture with a 10-year probability of hip fracture greater than 3% or major osteoporotic risk fracture greater than 20% as estimated by a tool like FRAX. And I think that's just a good way to think about who should be treated. Now, if they have clinical diagnosis or bone mineral density diagnosis of osteoporosis, they are a candidate for treatment. So that's just straightforward. They already have proven that they're at risk, they should be treated. And then those who are of low bone mass who've already had an osteoporosis-related fracture, again, they by definition have osteoporosis and they should be treated.
Right. Well, let's then chat more with the patient. So you review with the patient her DEXA results, probability of future fractures, and benefits and harms of medical therapy. She declines pharmacologic intervention and says that she will try exercise, try to reduce her smoking and alcohol intake. She will also be attentive to the amount of calcium and vitamin D in her diet. When should you repeat the DEXA?
Oh my goodness, Dr. Mohan, you keep putting me through my paces here. So there is no clear answer or clear data because we just don't have that to make guidelines. And so this is a lot of expert-based guidelines. Based on two studies, the United States Preventive Services Task Force found no benefit in repeating those bone mineral density measurements earlier than 4 to 8 years. However, baseline bone mineral density and projected time to develop osteoporosis may be useful in making individual screening, like interval decisions on DEXAs. So for example, only 10% of women with normal bone mineral density or osteopenia in one study developed osteoporosis by 15 years out, while 10% of women with more advanced low bone mass for osteopenia developed osteoporosis within 1 to 5 years. So thinking about it in terms of our patient, her T-score is minus 2.0. She's at that low bone mass. So you may wish to repeat the DEXA in 2 years, or in other words, a little sooner, because she might be at higher risk of progressing to full-blown osteoporosis. Now, a 2-year screening interval is supported by the NOF and other organizations and corresponds with, importantly, a point you made, Medicare reimbursement guidelines. Basically, you're not going to get it paid if it's more frequent than every 2 years and it needs to be a high-risk individual. Now, we've included in the reader a suggested interval for screening. Basically, if their T-score is normal to only minus 1.5, reasonable to do it every 10 to 15 years. And again, there's a case to be made that they maybe don't ever need a screening again. If they're in that a higher risk of minus 1.5 to minus 2 on their T-score, think about every 3 to 5 years. And if they're really at that T-score is a minus 2 to minus 2.5, then think 1 to 2 years. And again, with 2 years generally being the shortest duration it's going to get covered.
All right. Suppose your patient moved out of state for 5 years, delayed routine health maintenance activities, and then comes back, repeats a DEXA at age 67, 5 years after initial study, reports an L1 to 4 T-score of negative 2.6. So now that she has osteoporosis, would you recommend pharmacologic treatment? And if yes, with what agent?
Ooh, yes. Now we kind of get to the meat of the treatment side of this. And this is assuming, of course, Dr. Mohan, we've already recommended all the non-pharmacologic options, right? Okay. For those who can't see, Dr. Mohan is nodding vigorously. So basically, guidelines from all relevant professional organizations recommend starting postmenopausal women who have osteoporosis on pharmacologic therapy using a bisphosphonate. Specifically, the ones that are recommended are alendronate, resendronate, or zoledronic acid, or with the monoclonal antibody denosumab. And as a reminder, that one is actually every 6 months, and zoledronic acid can be done every 12 months. The bisphosphonates are considered first-line therapy for most patients because they increase bone mineral density and have been shown to reduce the risk of vertebral and hip fractures within 3 years of treatment. And that's very important. They've been shown to reduce the risk of fracture, which is the point of all of this. They also generally have a really good safety profile, and they are reasonably affordable. They cost significantly less than denosumab, which is a monoclonal antibody. Just a nice estimate of cost from the medical letter. Alendronate averages to about $13 a month. Resendronate, which is 35 milligrams weekly, averages to $149 a month. And then zoledronic acid as an IV infusion is $260 per infusion. But that does not include the hospital-associated charges, which can be substantial. And then denosumab, which is like $1,200 per dose, which you would give every 6 months. So basically, alendronate, by far and away, the most affordable option. Now, bisphosphonates, as a brief reminder from medical school, they act by inhibiting osteoclast-mediated bone resorption. Because their half-life in bone is so long, their beneficial effect on reducing fractures may last for years beyond stopping the drug. I explained to my patients that after 5 years of treatment, generally the medicine is still in their body and it is still doing work. And that's why we get to come off the medicine, which is great. Now, as a reminder, the main side effects to caution your patients about. Generally, kind of the only thing that we often see are mild gastrointestinal symptoms. And to avoid that esophageal irritation, patients are instructed to take, when they're taking the pills, with liquids in the morning on an empty stomach and to remain upright for at least 30 minutes. Basically, don't take the pill and then go to bed. That's the recommendation. And you really should generally try to avoid it. Bisphosphonates in patients who have active peptic ulcer disease, really bad reflux, if they have achalasia, esophageal strictures and Barrett's esophagus, or a history of Roux-en-Y bypass. For these patients, who you really don't want to use the oral bisphosphonate, IV zoledronic acid is a really good option and likely to get approved, which is a key point because otherwise it's an expensive drug. And of course, those who might have difficulty being adherent to taking pills on a regular basis. Now, one of the other effects with zoledronic acid to watch for is hypocalcemia. In fact, we literally use this in the hospital for patients who are symptomatically hypercalcemic from their cancers. And indeed, some patients can get flu-like symptoms after that infusion of zoledronic acid, but generally very well tolerated. Other things that you want to check, and this gets to that screening that everybody with osteoporosis should get, are serum calcium levels, vitamin D, and a basic metabolic panel to check for renal function. And generally, we should check it every year, particularly for patients who are getting IV zoledronic acid. And of course, if either calcium or vitamin D is low, you should obviously be repleting. And again, remember that vitamin D 25 hydroxy, which should be we should treat at 20 or lower. The lab might report it as low at less than 30, but that's not actually low in terms of benefiting from repletion. Both the oral and the IV bisphosphonates accumulate in patients who have really low renal function, and they are contraindicated in patients who have a creatinine clearance less than 30 to 35. Now, for these patients, denosumab can be a good alternative, and it has that fracture reduction benefit similar to bisphosphonates. As a reminder, it is a human monoclonal antibody to rank L, the protein that is responsible for activating those osteoclasts. And by inhibiting it, you decrease bone resorption. Now, denosumab also generally is pretty well tolerated. You can get some mild GI side effects after the infusion, and there is increased risk of infection and rash because it's a monoclonal antibody. Now, the big thing with denosumab, its big disadvantage is there's a rapid decrease, like a weakening of bone mineral density when you discontinue it. And in fact, there's a subsequent risk within 8 months of multiple vertebral fractures. So if you stop the denosumab therapy, they have a high risk of their bones getting worse. So before you start someone on denosumab, you need to counsel them because you're probably signing them up for a lifetime treatment as opposed to bisphosphonates. Other things to be aware of for all of the medications I just talked about, Dr. Mohan, is that there is a rare but obviously pretty serious adverse effect of osteonecrosis of the jaw and atypical femoral fractures like femoral neck or femoral head osteonecrosis. Now, the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw is highest in patients who are receiving the IV bisphosphonates for malignancy-related, like hypercalcemia. It's really important. So the people who are most likely to get this are cancer patients who are giving it to them to treat their hypercalcemia, not everybody else who are treating with osteoporosis. And the risk is thought to be related to the duration of treatment with both classes of medication, but it's hard to quantify because it really is quite rare. And the Mayo Decision Aid can be really helpful for having patients visualize it, as you called out, to really see what the risk is. I will just say my editorializing, this is a risk that I think often gets overemphasized, and I can't tell you how many dentists insist that I sign off for patients who are just getting dental work and have no cancer, and yes. So other medications, just kind of like our third line drugs for that we can use for osteoporosis treatment, we can use if we can't use the other drugs or the other drugs have failed, would be the selective estrogen receptor modulators, the SERMs, like raloxifene. And for this patient though, we don't have any of those contraindications. Renal function is fine, as far as we know. So we would start alendronate 70 milligrams weekly. Also, basically all the societies, professional societies agree that patients with osteoporosis should be undergoing vitamin D supplementation and sufficient calcium intake. Again, this is where Dr. Yi calls out, recommends 1,000 to 2,000 international units of vitamin D and continuing the 1,200 milligrams of calcium daily. You can direct them to the International Osteoporosis Foundation calcium calculator if they really want to see if they're getting enough from their dietary intake.
How long would you treat her with the medication?
Ooh. Okay, you're giving me questions where we don't have good evidence. So the optimal duration of bisphosphonate treatment remains uncertain. The risk of atypical fractures increases with time and duration of treatment. The American College of Physicians recommends treatment with bisphosphonates for 5 years and zoledronic acid for 3 years. And then you basically give them an extended drug holiday and you make that complicated decision about when you're going to repeat a DEXA, if you ever will. Recognizing that if you've given them that 5-year treatment window with the oral bisphosphonate, you have achieved risk reduction, which was your goal. Now, if you have them on denosumab, it's lifelong therapy, as we mentioned, because you can make them fracture if you stop it.
All right, which then begs the question of when are you going to repeat a DEXA?
Yeah, like I said, this is a complicated decision. So the Endocrine Society recommends checking yearly, and if you didn't hear my tone there, while the American College of Physicians recommends not checking the bone mineral density during treatment. I will say different clinicians do different things. I actually side with ACP. Dr. Yi kind of splits the difference and checks 2 years into treatment to assess response. Basically looking for is that bone mineral density at least stable to improving, and then considering checking at the end of treatment. Assuming you decide to go on drug holiday once you've completed treatment, you can monitor the DEXA periodically. Dr. Yi's suggestion is every 2 years because this is someone who was at high risk and you're following for changes. And this will lead to, I think, another very complicated question that you're probably going to ask, which is what do we do if that DEXA changes? But what is your next question, Dr. Mohan?
Yes, so I'll be kind and I will not ask you what to do when the DEXA changes. Although I will say that whenever I brought that up with endocrinology, their answer is put them back on the bisphosphonate, please and thank you. So that is usually their very straightforward question. But instead, I'm going to ask you about very high risk patients for fracture. So first, how do you define them? And then how would you treat them?
This is a great question. And it's an area where there has been relatively recent changes in like general consensus amongst experts on how to approach it. So very high risk is usually defined as having had multiple fractures and a bone mineral density T-score at the hip or spine less than minus 2.5, or a T-score that is minus 3.0 independent of fractures. So basically people who keep breaking or their number is super low, those are considered very high risk. And in these patients, there is probably significant additional benefit, or at least somewhat additional benefit, to starting with what are called anabolic agents. So these work differently, and kind of the main class are the parathyroid hormone analogs. And these are medicines that are expensive, generally our endocrinologists manage it, although arguably there's no reason we can't do it in primary care. The original drug in this class was teriparatide, and then there's another one, abiloparatide, and then the newest drug, which is a monoclonal antibody, romanusumab, and this one works differently than the two PTH analogs. It's a monoclonal antibody targeting sclerostin, which is an inhibitor of bone formation. This monoclonal antibody is not approved for men, and it's not for women with a high cardiovascular risk, or who those who basically had strokes. And when you compare head-to-head this monoclonal antibody to teriparatide, given at their licensed doses, to postmenopausal women who are at high risk of fracture, bone mineral density significantly increased with romanusumab by 11.3% at the spine, 4.1% at the hip, and 3.7% at the femoral neck, compared with increases with teriparatide of basically 7.1% at the spine, so 4% less, 1.3% at the hip, 3% less, and 1.1% at the femoral neck, which is like 3% less. So basically, this is an area of evolution and change and kind of an increasing emphasis for those at super high risk. We should go on one of these anabolic agents, and the monoclonal antibody might be the kind of go-to in the near future. This is very reasonable to send them to endocrinology if you have access to endocrinology. And of course, if you identify a secondary cause for osteoporosis, again, we were mentioning those earlier, we might want to be referring them anyways. And your patients with chronic kidney disease, it's a really complicated decision on treatment, probably also reasonable to send them to endocrinology.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Shenoy, for an excellent review of osteoporosis and really highlighting the general guidelines for screening, which we definitely don't do enough of, how to define osteoporosis and really highlighting that that is a clinical diagnosis. It is not just based off of one measurement on a DEXA scan. And then what are the non-pharmacologic and pharmacologic options for treatment, how you would choose your preferred treatment, and then how frequently we should be monitoring a person with a DEXA scan. Anything else you wish to add as final takeaways for our residents and listeners?
No, thank you, Dr. Mohan. I think that was a great summation. The other point I'll bring up that when we were preparing for this, we discussed is this can often be a good intro to talking about goals of care, particularly with our older, really frail patients and thinking big picture. It's not just about the number and about fall risk. It's what is their trajectory of their health. So, with that, I hope everybody has a wonderful week, and we will hopefully see everybody back next week.
Bye, everyone.